Dear viewers of Auf Eins, today I have the great honor to interview Dr. Peter McCullough for Auf Eins. As there are a lot of things to report on, I'm already excited about the content of this interview. Thank you for your interest.
Dr. Peter McCullough, dear Peter, thank you so much for taking the time. There is so much going on, and I think we could do a 3-hour interview easily. Please tell us, first of all, thank you to the Peter McCullough Foundation, your whole team. What you are revealing, what you are bringing out to the world is the best. You know, we are just taking all your data, sucking it in. It's wonderful and it's important. And again, thank you. As I said, so many topics. What is the latest, biggest work you did when it comes especially to the determinants on autism, when it comes to the latest other findings? Can you guide us through what the breaking news were coming out of Peter McCullough Foundation science?
You know, coming out of the pandemic, the global pandemic, as things began to settle, as an epidemiologist, I'm an internist and cardiologist and president of the McCullough Foundation, we started to look at the landscape of chronic diseases, and this is an area that I have not focused on, and that is pediatric chronic disease. But it became apparent over the decades there is a true epidemic of allergic diseases, so asthma, allergic dermatitis, food allergies, as well as an epidemic of neuropsychiatric disorders. That's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, autism spectrum disorder, tics, and seizures. So these two categories skyrocketing in children. Now, if we add in obesity and diabetes, we have over half of children have a chronic disease. And when you and I were children, virtually no one had a chronic disease. So at the McCullough Foundation, we did obtain independent grant funding, and we embarked on the most comprehensive assessment of autism spectrum disorder, which in the United States is now 1 in 31 children. That's 3.2% of all American children. And 27% of that group has profound autism, meaning they can't speak, they can't interact with their parents, they can't toilet alone. They're going to be dependent on 24/7 care the rest of their lives. And so we not only fully described this rapidly developing epidemic of autism, but we looked at it just like we would with heart disease, understanding heart disease is complicated. There's no single cause, but there's risk factors. And for autism, there must be risk factors. And so surveying the literature, hundreds and hundreds of peer-reviewed manuscripts, you know, going from epidemiologic studies, codified data, prospective cohort studies, and very convincingly case vignettes when the child is examined, the parents are interviewed, the vaccine records are interviewed, other environmental exposures are accounted for. We assembled a wheel, and that's the image that people have in their mind when they think about this McCullough Foundation report. And the wheel outlines the risk factors. So risk factors include older parents. So a man over age 40, a woman over age 35, our data support that. A premature delivery, a baby born before 37 weeks of gestation. Common genetic factors, but I mean common. They're in more than 25% of them, but they appear to have some susceptibility to the development of autism. They lay the foundation for this. So genetics do play a role. In utero exposures. Now, importantly, an exposure that a woman, when she's pregnant, would take for the entire pregnancy, every day. And we're talking about heavy-duty neuropsychiatric drugs, so antipsychotics, anti-epileptics, serious antidepressants, not a dose of Tylenol. Okay, so we analyzed this, and that's at least half of autism is this predisposing factor. Then you say, okay, well, does that mean they're going to get autism? Well, we were able to identify throughout history a few sporadic cases of autism, even before the advent of vaccines, but it really was vaccines. And even Leo Kanner, the child psychiatrist who originally described autism, one out of the 11 children in his case series had just taken the smallpox vaccine in the 1940s. And when we examined the vaccines, it was clear. You know, there's over 20 vaccines that in the package insert describes the vaccines causing encephalitis, inflammation of the brain. So as we surveyed this literature, we concluded that vaccines given in combinations, once they became available as measles, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, and they had others in and co-administration all at once, getting to 5, 10, 15 shots all at once, that in susceptible child, there almost certainly is subclinical encephalitis. The child becomes irritable, there can be a fever, a febrile seizure, and then from that moment forward, the child regresses and develops the phenotypic expression of autism. So combination vaccines, clearly a risk factor for the development of autism in a predisposed child. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the report is finalized. It's published on the European Commission server October 27th of 2025. Within, and we send it to Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy, Donald L. Trump. We send it to everyone, and they're on our feeds as well. Within 19 days, the CDC on its website says, you know, we were wrong on this. We can't rule out the connection between vaccines and autism. And then within 90 days of our report, Trump tells the interim director of the CDC, Jim O'Neill, now Trump not being a doctor, O'Neill not being a doctor, Trump just says, trim the schedule. And so we went from 17 vaccine-preventable diseases to 11, dropped the number of doses by 55. And I think the big ones of concern are still on the schedule. I think politically they chose the vaccines that would have the least resistance from pediatric societies. So that's where we are. So we're about 90 days after the McCullough Foundation report on autism, and we had a big impact.
Wow. Congratulations. We watched that, of course. So going to an interview that I recently watched with you, you were asked about the flu vaccine, right? And you as a doctor, cardiologist yourself, you admitted, of course, you took it back in the days, right? Would you do that again?
No, I wouldn't. You know, I took 40 flu shots. Originally, years ago, we were told, you know, it's good for you. Take a flu shot. Maybe you would spread it to patients. So I was a young doctor. I said, okay, well, what's the big deal? I take a flu shot. Then over time, it said, you know, if you don't take a flu shot, we're not going to renew your medical staff privileges. Then in the last few years, it said, if you don't take a flu shot, we're locking you out of the hospital. It became that. And so a couple times it was, you know, New Year's Eve, and I was scrambling to get a flu shot. I said, wait a minute, this is getting coercive.
Yeah.
It's getting coercive. And then sure enough, you know, around mid, I think 2015, there was a prospective randomized trial in children of the influenza vaccine. And it did lower rates of influenza a little bit. It's partially effective. But it increases the risk of the common cold. And that's what was my problem. I was getting sick multiple times per year. Once we had gotten to 2020 and 2021, I think I was sick every month. Mm-hmm. I literally had one sore throat evolving into a cold. Mm-hmm. And my wife has said, you're just never well. Mm-hmm. And now a big paper from Shretha and colleagues, Cleveland Clinic, 51,000 employees, those who take a flu shot are more likely to develop common colds and the flu. It's completely backfired.
Wow, yeah. Here you go. That's a fair statement, and it's,
Do you take them? You're a doctor.
No, I never took. Took a flu shot. No, never.
Wow.
I can state that. But, of course, the other vaccines that you had to have so you could study medicine, etc., that's
sure.
The other story.
Did you take measles vaccine?
I had it as a child, yeah.
Well, there's an important paper by Bianchi and colleagues at an Italian medical school. And this is at a time where about half the students actually had natural measles by the time they enroll in medical school, and half took the vaccine. So it was a perfect study. It turned out those who had the natural measles, 96% had serological titers. They had immune protection against measles. That's the reason why you only get it once. But the vaccinated students, only 80% had protection.
Yes.
80%. So now, you know, the World Health Organization tells us some years worldwide, there's 600,000 cases of measles. In the EU, where you are, sometimes over 250,000 cases of measles. So why is it a big deal if we have 2,000 cases in the United States? And it's in the press every single day.
Yeah.
Because those who are pressing for vaccination want to use measles as the case example for vaccination.
Yes.
Now, it's true. The measles vaccine lowers the case count. However, there's consequences. And there was a paper published from Stanford. This is really a horrific vignette where a baby takes the measles vaccine. And the doctors didn't know the baby was in the development phase of contracting acute myelogenous leukemia. Mm. And so measles is a live attenuated virus. And sure enough, the baby was immunocompromised. That measles organism mutated in the baby, and the baby developed a fatal encephalitis. In fact, the vaccine essentially destroyed this baby's brain. And the baby died, had an autopsy, and it's published by Stanford. So the point is, the measles vaccine is not perfectly safe. And if one examines our vaccine adverse event reporting system, you'll be shocked to know, since 1990, there's been over 1,000 measles, mumps, rubella-related deaths. There hasn't been that many measles deaths since 1990.
Exactly. And also, you are also interviewed in the documentary An Inconvenient Study, which will have its premiere here in Guernsey, and it's the European premiere. And the results, you saw the study, you read the study. What is your, you say it in the film, but here for the audience, what was your first thought about this study?
Well, you know, this gives a chance to kind of give the backstory here. So years ago, decades ago, I was the associate director of the Center for Clinical Effectiveness and the program director in cardiovascular diseases at Henry Ford Hospital. The doctor portrayed in the film, Dr. Mark Zervos, was a colleague of mine, not only at Henry Ford, but also at William Beaumont Hospital. I know him personally. In fact, Zervos is an author on the very first McCullough Protocol paper published for early treatment of COVID-19 in the American Journal of Medicine. So there's a connection there. And when the film crew was filming the Inconvenient Study, you know, I wasn't informed that the film, what the title of the film was or what it was about. So I was being asked some general questions, and then I was handed this manuscript. And I was asked to react to it right away. So, and I did, and you can see my response on the film. And sure enough, I received a legal threat letter from Henry Ford a few weeks later that, you know, has me under now a legal threat that I could face an individual lawsuit regarding it. So I can't say anything more here regarding this, but you can tell that we're in a very tense moment in medical history.
Mm-hmm. Good. Coming back to the vaccines that are still on the market, one of them is the COVID-19 vaccine. In the USA, in Austria, we talked about that. Mm-hmm. We literally don't know of any country in the world that really pulled them off the market. What is going on, Peter?
It's stunning. How many people in Austria took the vaccine? What percent? Do you know?
I would say at around 80% took one or two.
Really?
And then three, maybe still 78%. That's
really?
Like my numbers with what
wow.
I saw. And there was still this group of, let's say, 15 to 20% that have zero COVID-19 vaccines.
Now, I wasn't vaccine risk aware, including my influenza shots. I had taken 69 doses of vaccines.
Wow.
I traveled to a tropical forest. I was told I should take more vaccines, and I've never had any side effects from any vaccines, so I didn't think much about it. But in 2020, I did contract COVID. I was the first to publish McCullough Protocol, the most widely used treatment protocol to treat COVID-19 in the world. And you know, as a capstone to my career, McCullough Protocol has been credited with saving tens of millions of lives and sparing hundreds of millions of hospitalizations. The COVID vaccines didn't do that. I don't think the COVID vaccine saved a single life. And I'll never forget, every Monday at my medical school, in you know where I practiced, we had cardiac pathology, and we would be in a group. And one of the young residents said he was a subject in the trial, the Pfizer's trial. He said, I've taken the vaccine. And I said, you know, it's messenger RNA.
Modified messenger RNA. It's not even the natural stuff.
But at that time, I didn't fully understand, you know, this degree of synthetic change. But I said, you know, there are endogenous reverse transcriptase, and it's messenger RNA. I said, it's likely, you know, the human body's going to read the code, produce a matching piece of DNA, and that's going to readily go into the nucleus. I said, they could reverse transcribe. And immediately the young resident looked at me, and I'm going to say this is about October of 2020. He goes, that's been ruled out. What? Ruled out.
When?
And I just noticed that, you know, it was his immediate response. And, you know, even early in 2021, I went on with Dr. Drew Pinsky. Mm-hmm. Drew is on the chief medical board with me at the wellness company. And at the time, he did the same thing. He goes, oh, that's been ruled out. I go, no, it hasn't. And no, it hasn't been ruled out at all. So the messenger RNA vaccine platform came on the market with no pharmacokinetics, no genotoxicity is what we've been talking about, no oncogenicity, no teratogenicity studies. Now people say, well, it was an emergency. It was COVID-19 and this urgency to get the vaccines on the market. I say, well, wait a minute. Moderna has a respiratory syncytial virus messenger RNA vaccine. There's no emergency there. We have an antigen vaccine. Pfizer's got an antigen vaccine. Why did we rush the Moderna vaccine out with no pharmacokinetics, no genotoxicity? So the point I'm making is there's something very wrong with the messenger RNA platform. It is not being scrutinized. It's not being adequately tested or developed. There's no ability to shut this off. So think about this. Pfizer and Moderna, recognizing here in Europe, many people took the AstraZeneca vaccine, but Pfizer and Moderna, it codes for the spike protein. That's the lethal part of the virus that was engineered in a Chinese biosecurity lab. So people who have taken this vaccine have taken the synthetic genetic code for a lethal bioengineered protein.
Exactly.
It's like a science fiction movie, right, but playing out in real time. And you know, in August of 2020, by invitation, I had been writing op-eds in The Hill, the most widely read journal for the House, the Senate, and the White House. And in August of 2020, I published an op-ed, and the title of it was The Great Gamble of the COVID-19 Vaccine Development Program. Mm-hmm. Do you know you're talking to the only public figure in the world who did that? Mm-hmm. No one in Europe, mm-hmm. no one in South America, no one in Africa, mm-hmm. no one in Canada. Even Robert F. Kennedy didn't do this. Mm-hmm. Nobody in the vaccine community, nobody from the higher wire did this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The entire world was seduced on messenger RNA. They were told a story that this was going to save humanity. There was tremendous fear. It's the summer of 2020. We've already seen people die of SARS-CoV-2 infection. Everyone was seduced, even the biggest vaccine skeptics. At the time, I wasn't a vaccine skeptic. Mm-hmm. In fact, I accepted all the vaccines. But somehow I saw this as a red flag. And sure enough, a month later, I got COVID myself. My wife got it. I had some pulmonary involvement. I was treating patients early, but I got through it. And then as they rolled out December 10th, 2020, I get a text from one of the coordinators at my hospital. It said, it's time for you to get your vaccine. I said, I just had COVID. I'm good. I have natural immunity. No, you should get one anyway. We just don't get... If I had, as a kid, chickenpox, which I did, I wouldn't just take another chickenpox vaccine.
2 months later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you know that women of childbearing potential were specifically excluded from the messenger RNA program. And in the first week of public administration, which was largely for young doctors and nurses, that's where they rolled it out. They didn't roll it out to nursing homes, interesting. The nursing home patients were dying. They didn't roll it out there. They rolled it out to young doctors and nurses. But in that first week, 3,000 pregnant American nurses took the messenger RNA vaccine. And a month earlier, they would have been excluded from the clinical trial. When I saw that, I said something is really gone wrong.
Yes. When we are talking about the situation in the United States, if you could say we live in a perfect world, what would be the logic next steps for a perfect health system?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say we had leadership say, well, Dr. McCullough, you go on national TV, you're critical of the administrations. It's true, I have been critical of the administrations, but I've also brought the world very, very important solutions.
Yes.
So I'll be critical of the current administration. And the only way to be critical is to say what I would do if I was in those roles. Okay. So let's take Health and Human Services, Secretary of Health and Human Services. We had previously we had Alex Azar. He's a former drug company CEO. He was the one where the vaccines were rolled out. Then we had Xavier Becerra, who's a former legislator, an attorney. And now we have Robert F. Kennedy, who's an activist and an attorney from a storied family. I think the Secretary of Health and Human Services should be a doctor and a doctor who has medical authority. We've had now 6 years of continual crisis. Part of it is because we don't have a qualified doctor in that role. And we can't have an attorney be the supervisor of a doctor. That's inverted. No, doctors need to supervise the attorneys. So if I was Secretary of Health and Human Services, on day one, I would have pulled the COVID-19 vaccines off the market, all of them. Not safe for human use. I would have had a press release. And people would say, well, you would need approval from Donald Trump. Well, it's not the president's call on whether a biopharmaceutical stays on the market or not. It's simply not his call. So if he didn't like it, I'd say, sorry, this is my call, because it's, you know, it's
my field of expertise.
It's then medical authority. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's off the market immediately. And then my next step is I would call what traditionally we call them Bethesda meetings, Bethesda, Maryland. I would call in all the chiefs of medicine and the chief medical officers and probably the CEO of the 350 major medical schools and medical centers in the United States for a Bethesda meeting. And I'd say, let's review the data on the COVID-19 vaccines. Let's review the estimates of, you know, over 500,000 Americans who've died of this vaccine by estimates. Let's review the vignettes of 1,100 Americans who die on the same day they take the shot.
Yes.
And 1,200 then next day they take the shots. And let's review 4,000 to 5,000 papers on vaccine injuries, disabilities, and deaths, and what's happening with the messenger RNA, the adenoviral DNA, the antigen-based vaccines, and of course the spike protein, which is accumulated in people's bodies. I would have everybody in a room look at the data together. Who did that in the past? Luther Terry, 1964. Doctors were ensconced in smoking. They were lobbied by the tobacco industry. They gave out cigarettes in their offices. Their nurses smoked. Doctors were on advertisements. Luther Terry calls all the doctors to Washington who are smoking and says, I've got bad news. I've got the Surgeon General report on smoking. That's leadership. I would have done that day one.
Mm-hmm.
Day one. Not a year later. That's on the COVID vaccines. Now, Robert F. Kennedy came into office. He said, well, I'm going to deliver an answer on autism. Well, okay. You know, the CDC has 12,000 employees credentialed like you and I are. 12,000. They have a $9 billion budget. Mm. For decades, no report on autism, nothing like what the McCullough Foundation did. All those decades, they can't review the literature. The CDC has an autism spectrum network. Over the decades, they've got 25,000 children with autism in a database. 27% of them have profound autism. Immediately, I would link that data to the vaccine records. Immediately, we'd call in and interview the parents. Immediately, we would examine the children, qualified neurologists. We'd do gene expression studies. Immediately.
Yes.
I mean, these agencies have billions of dollars at their disposal. They have the answers right there. This idea of delivering an answer on autism, it's right in front of them. I would have done that immediately. What happened? September 22nd, there's a press conference. Robert F. Kennedy says, well, we're going to have an answer by September. Well, none of that, what I mentioned, was done on day one. So they get to September, they still haven't done anything. And the most awkward press conference comes up. You have Trump, Robert F. Kennedy, Dr. Oz, Martin Makary, and Jay Bhattacharya. And the body language is incredibly awkward. And Trump comes to the microphone, and he says, we've got the answer. We know what causes autism. Oh, you do? Well, what's the answer? He goes, I can't pronounce, what is it? How do you pronounce it? It's acetaminophen, Tylenol. And everyone's like, what? What? The mother took a capsule of Tylenol 3 years ago, and this is what caused the autism in the baby now? And that story was put out there on September 22nd. And it's interesting that Robert F. Kennedy, Dr. Oz, and the other doctors, they stayed on the storyline. Well, yes, there's some meta-analytic data and Trump couldn't keep the storyline. Before you know it, Trump goes, well, really, it's the vaccines. The kids are getting too many vaccines at once. So he actually couldn't. And so what I think happened is I think they were going to tell America that combination vaccines were a risk factor for autism. And somebody at the last minute said, no, don't you dare do that. Go out there and tell them it's Tylenol. Well, listen, we looked at this, McCullough yes. Foundation. The Swedish did a beautiful study, Altquist and colleagues, published in JAMA 2004. 2 million Swedish pregnancies. They have every capsule of Tylenol accounted for. Some of these women actually have had multiple children. So they have a pregnancy where they took some Tylenol, they have a pregnancy where they didn't. So they have sibling analysis. They have it nailed down. Let me tell you, Tylenol taken during pregnancy has nothing to do with autism. Mm-hmm. Nothing. And Trump ill-advised, embarrassed himself. Robert F. Kennedy, the doctors embarrassed themselves. And immediately, all the physician societies pounded them. The manufacturer of Tylenol, Kendall, immediately sues the government. And the president of, he comes on the financial news stations and says, I like our odds in court. Mm. I mean, we can't have our government health officials embarrass themselves. We have lots of experts out there. They need to pick up the phone, get expert advice. This is very important.
Yeah, the citizens of a country deserve the truth.
Well, we have to admit that government jobs are poorly paid. Most don't want to leave their families and go to Washington. We don't have the brightest minds in public health in anywhere in the United States.
And if you think of a country criticizing another country for harming their people for whatever reason, right? Mm. But they have the data on the table in written words, and they just keep having something on the market that is harming their own citizens.
Well, now a very important paper was published in JAMA in the last 6 months. First author is Vesuvian. 60% of parents are not going to go through this full vaccine schedule. Mm. They're not doing it. And so at the state level, for instance, I live in Texas. We have, thanks to activist organizations like Texans for Vaccine Choice, which I support, we have medical, religious, and philosophical exemptions. So as a parent, if you don't want your child to take any vaccines, you download a form, fill it out, get it notarized, put it on file with the school, you're done.
In most states, right?
It's mixed.
Okay.
It's mixed.
Yeah.
Now, some states, for instance, California, effectively there's no option out of getting vaccinated. The doctors can't write exemptions. There's no religious. There's no philosophical of interest. California has the highest rate of vaccination in the United States, and they have the highest rate of autism.
Here you go. That's the numbers, plain numbers. So, Peter, the McCullough Foundation is putting out so much work, and we talked about autism now. What is another thing that you want to let the public know about what your great team is achieving?
That's very important. You know, people ask, you know, why was the McCullough Foundation even formed? People reached out to me all over the world and said, listen, how can we support you? And what I have found through the pandemic is a lack of accountability. Who's really responsible for these vaccines? And I said, listen, the work I do, I'm accountable for. My name is on the foundation. I'm accountable for our investigative scholarship, our work in the media, our work in the courts, and in public policy. I'm accountable. And we set out to solve a very big problem. patients who had had the infection multiple times, had accumulated the spike protein in their body, and were developing a long COVID syndrome, which is due to the spike protein. They had taken vaccines, Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, Janssen, and Novavax, and they got more spike protein, and they've developed a post-vaccine syndrome. So we set out to find a solution. And over the years, I tried every prescription drug. My patients had explored all types of therapies, stem cells and immunoglobulins. Nothing was working. And our scholarship led us to the Japanese, who had discovered that nattokinase, a natural enzyme derived from the fermentation of soy or chickpeas, it dissolves the spike protein. They also discovered that bromelain, a set of enzymes from pineapple stems and the meat of a pineapple, it also dissolves spike protein. And there was like 14 trials of using curcumin derived from turmeric that blocks the spike protein's inflammation. So three natural products were so imminently available to us to try this. And so we began using this in practice. Patients were getting taken different combinations. We worked on doses. And we published our first paper in 2023 in the Journal of the American Physician and Surgeon on the proposal to do this. Now, this is interesting. The day that came out, I made a little graphical abstract of the protocol, and I put it out on social media. Instantly, within seconds, a community note came up and says, warning, this doesn't work. I said, wait a minute. I'm just proposing to do this. How does somebody know this doesn't work? And the only times we've seen that before is hydroxychloroquine in the original Mukala protocol, ivermectin, and Pierre Corey's book gives Corey a lot of credit, The War on Ivermectin. Vitamin D, we saw that with vitamin D. We saw that with nasal sprays and gargles, incredibly suppressed, and monoclonal antibodies, expensive, high-tech, Operation Warp Speed, suppressed. The point is, anything that really works is immediately suppressed. In my first book, we described this biopharmaceutical complex that we think there is actually a group out there that is doing anything they can to try to, in their minds, they are trying to stamp out vaccine hesitancy.
And if there would have been a working COVID-19 therapy, the EMA could not have given the emergency use.
But you're assuming they would play by the rules.
Yeah.
I think no one was playing by the rules. I think the reason why these therapies were snuffed out is not for some regulatory rule. Is because if therapies were available, they may lead to vaccine hesitancy. The World Health Organization...
people would have just had their stock at
right,
home. If I get sick, I have something.
Yeah, I can skip the vaccine. The World Health Organization says that vaccine hesitancy is a threat to public health. And there are, 20 different published instruments of vaccine hesitancy. It's essentially considered a mental disease. So that's what these organizations do when they are suppressing. So they tried to suppress Mukala protocol-based spike detoxification. I was just trying to help people with long COVID and vaccine injury syndromes. Now, fast forward years later, I've treated thousands of patients. We've actually formed the wellness company now, a company that supplies these products in combination, and we've had enormous success. We're documenting measurements of spike load go down the body, patients getting better. And so here we are. We're at a juncture. We have the peer-reviewed publications. This is perfect for Robert F. Kennedy and the new crew in Washington, who has billions of dollars at their disposal to do a large, prospective, double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial and test Mukala protocol-based spike detoxification in patients with long COVID or after the vaccines.
Yeah.
Now, what happened? The Biden administration spent $1 billion on this. It was called the HHS Long COVID Research Program. Not a single one of the funded studies even mentioned the spike protein, which is the cause of the syndrome, never measured it, had no therapies that addressed the spike protein. To them, it was just a mysterious form of inflammation. And after $1 billion were spent, no protocols, no new therapies, no help for people. So what we've done at the Mukala Foundation is we have brought an organized, protocol-driven approach. And if the government agencies show an interest and we want to conduct a randomized trial, we have the products ready to go. I can tell you a lot of people, and a lot of people here today, are not going to wait you know, 4 to 10 years for a randomized trial. They're saying, listen, these are natural products. We're having great success. And I put my name on it, and I copyright it with my name for a reason. It's not patented, but it's copyrighted for accountability. Mm. Because if this doesn't work, believe me, on social media, I'd be slammed. People would be slamming, Dr. McCullough, I tried your protocol, and it did fail, or there are side effects, what have you. All I get is a steady stream of compliments. Thank you. I'm finally better. Now, we're using products now in high doses. For some of the severe patients here we've met at the venue, some will need 16,000 units of natokinase a day. Now, the safety limit, we believe, is about 80,000. The Japanese have published this, so 16,000, but we're up there. Bromelain, 1,000 milligrams a day. Curcumin, 2,000 milligrams a day. The side effects can be bleeding. The products that we're working with now are derived from chickpeas, so we don't have to worry about soy allergies. But people need these for about a year or more to begin to clear the spike protein out. And we measure the antibody against the spike protein as an indirect proxy, and soon we're going to have a direct measurement.
Well, you see, it's the antibodies from the vaccines. You worked with the German laboratory even.
Right, and the German laboratory will show data. Yes. In one of my patients where we can actually directly measure the spike protein, mm-hmm. and we can directly find the messenger RNA. Now, this is alarming, but in this man who's taken 3 Pfizer shots, who's had blood clots and pulmonary embolism, MRI confirmed myocarditis, he's been ruined by these vaccines. 3.5 years after his last dose of Pfizer, he has circulating messenger RNA in his bloodstream and circulating vaccine spike protein. It's not leaving the human body. The only way to do this is to use McCullough protocol-based spike protein detoxification. He's been on the protocol for about 6 months. We've had tremendous clearing of spike out of his bloodstream, but he's going to need it for years.
Yeah. Peter, thank you so much for the hard work you are doing. Thank you to your whole team. Also, Nick Halscher, just saw an interview with him exactly about what you said now in the end. The 3.5 years is a shocker because somebody would think and hope, oh, maybe it's just gone within a couple of weeks or a month. It isn't. You show the proof working with laboratories.
You know, I get a good question from someone. So, Dr. McCullough, people take the shots, they get so much spike protein, and the antibody levels go so high. With such high antibodies against the spike protein, how do they get COVID so easily? You think with all those antibodies, they'd be protected. And the answer is these vaccines are always behind. So by the time they come out, the vaccine is already mutated, and there's high antibodies to the prior strain,
right.
And now there's a new strain that just readily infects the patient.
Of course, because the virus mutates. That's how it goes. But it's their story, and they want to still push it hard, but I'm thankful that you're out there, and you're definitely not speaking because somebody told you you have to say that. You can't say that. You're authentic. That is what I really appreciate about you.
Thank you.
And people who listen to you here, you're here to spread the word, spread the truth, and as I always like to say, God and the good will prevail, and we definitely have a lot of help from the side of good people doing good things out there in the world, and you're definitely one of my heroes. Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you. And you know, and thanks to you and all of your efforts and certainly those here at the program. If I could leave anybody with, you know, a final word, that is to seek the truth, be bold and be relentless, and understand this is a very long journey. Our controversies in medicine don't end quickly. Our big ones regarding cocaine addiction in physicians and nurses, smoking addiction, and now the success of vaccination. Each one of these controversies lasted over half a century.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're in for a long haul.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you.
Dear viewers, thank you for your interest in this interview. Stay tuned for more interviews from the conference on Guernsey Island. Thank you.